About 30 people attended. This is the wedding. Kunda and Janaki. The decorations were similar to the ones for the initiation a few days before, except they were more festive and the feast was more lavish. Swamiji's front room was decorated with pine boughs, and leaves and flowers were strung overhead from one side of the room to the other. Some of the new initiates came, their large red beads around their necks. They had taken vows now, 16 rounds a day, and they chanted on their beads, just as Swamiji had shown them. And they happily, though self-consciously, called one another by their new spiritual names. Janaki. Swamiji said that I should wear a sari at my wedding, and he said it should be made of silk. I asked him what color, and he said red. So Mukunda bought me an absolutely elegant sari and some very nice jewelry. The Swami's friends were used to seeing Janaki as she always came with Mukunda, but usually she wore no makeup and dressed in very plain clothes. They were astounded and somewhat embarrassed to see her enter wearing jewelry, makeup, and a bright red sari. The bride's hair was up and braided, decorated with an oval silver filigree hair ornament. She wore heavy silver earrings, which Mukunda had purchased from an expensive Indian import shop on Fifth Avenue, and silver bracelets. The dresses and the jewelry that the brides wear at the wedding, something looks like they weigh about 30 pounds. It's really amazing the stuff they put on. Prabhupada directed Mukunda and Janaki to sit opposite him on the other side of the sacrificial fire arena. And just as at the initiation, he lit the incense and instructed them in the purification by water, recited the purification mantra, and then began to speak. He explained about the relationship between man and wife in Krishna consciousness, and how they should serve each other and how they should serve Krishna. Prabhupada then asked Janaki's sister to present her formally to Mukunda as his wife. Mukunda then repeated after Swamiji, "I accept Janaki as my wife, and I shall take charge of her throughout both of our lives. We shall live together peacefully in Krishna consciousness, and there will never be any separation." And then Prabhupada turned to Janaki, "Will you accept Sriman Mukunda Das Brahmachari as your life's companion? Will you serve him always and help him to execute his Krishna conscious activities?" And then Janaki replied, "Yes, I accept Mukunda as my husband throughout my life. There should never be any separation between us, either in happiness or distress. I shall serve him always, and we shall live together peacefully in Krishna consciousness." No one knew anything of what was going on except Swamiji. He led the chanting, he gave the lines for the bride and groom to exchange, he told them where to sit and what to do, he, in fact, had told them to get married. He had also cooked the elaborate feast that was waiting in the kitchen for the completion of the ceremony. Prabhupada asked Mukunda and Janaki to exchange their flower garlands and after that to exchange sitting places. He then asked Mukunda to rub some vermilion down the part in Janaki's hair and then to cover her head with her sari. Next came the fire sacrifice and finally the feast. This is a big surrender, and Prabhupada, usually, especially people growing up in the United States, nobody tells anyone to get married. But that's like that. I mean, maybe some countries might still be like that, but it's generally not like that here. Prabhupada had such high regard and love for Prabhupada that he asked him, they wanted to learn from him, so he said, "You should get married." So they got married. It's a big life decision, and maybe they were thinking of it anyway, but or maybe not. But when Prabhupada asked them to do it, they did it. That's a real surrender. It's like in the preparation from the feast, Mother Jamuna, she said she was macrobiotic, and macrobiotic was like, you know, it's all, you know, no butter, no, you know, just very real plain, like brown rice. And brown rice, you know, it's pretty tough and everything. But there was, I don't know if it's still around, but there was a pretty big fad back then, Michel Kushi and macrobiotic diet. And a lot of young people were into it. And so she was used to that. And then she comes to the feast, and there's ghee and butter and sugar everywhere. And she's trying to eat at the feast, and it was hard for her to eat. She said she was having to choke down her food, the prasadam, and she's thinking, I'll never do this again. And then, but she did it. And at the end, because she did it, because Prabhupada wanted her to do it. And she was the first time meeting Prabhupada, she did, but she was destined or meant by Krishna to be his disciple, very great devotee, his disciple of Prabhupada. And so she was immediately attractive, and she did what he told her. Even at the end, when she was so full, and she didn't want to eat anymore, and Prabhupada gave her a big fat lunchman to eat, and she didn't want to eat it. But Prabhupada handed it to her and asked her to eat it, and she did. So these are real surrenders. Very real, very brand new devotees just doing things that they wouldn't have thought possible the day before they met Prabhupada, but now they were doing them gladly, at least willingly. Maybe not gladly, but willingly, for sure. And in the marriage ceremony, there should never be any separation between us. And that, you know, we have the experience that people get married and they separate. They get divorced. It's certainly not at all unusual. But Prabhupada didn't like it. And after a few years of taking part in marriage ceremonies for his disciples, he bowed out. He didn't want to take part in it anymore because so many of the marriages weren't doing very well. So he said, and then it was taken, marriages were taken care of by temple presidents and GBCs, and there was still, direction. A lot of times marriages were arranged still by GBC, people, temple presidents. And some worked and some didn't, just like all the time. Some arranged marriages work and some don't. But anyway, marriage is a part of life. Almost everyone gets married, and almost everyone has children. Very few people are sannyasis or brahmacharis or brahmacharinis for their whole life, but we have many great examples of devotees like that. But most people aren't. Most people get married, and the age of Kali, married people fight also, and they get divorced. But nothing can stop the onward progress of Krishna consciousness. The husband is still a devotee, the wife is still a devotee, and everyone goes their separate ways, but everyone is still very dear to Krishna, and what could be a lifetime relationship is it may not be, but anyway, it's just the marriage, like everything else, the marriage is just an aid to help us get through this life in a relatively peaceful condition so we can serve Krishna in a dedicated way and then go back home, back to God. Marriage is not in and of itself some wonderful institution, but it is an institution that can help people progress in spiritual life, then it's a good thing. I just read a little more than I want to learn Varahadi. The special feature of the wedding was the big feast. It turned out to be quite a social success. The guests ate enthusiastically, asked for more, and raved about the sensational tastes. Prabhupada's followers, who were accustomed to the simple daily fare of rice, dal, sabji, and chapatis, found the feast intoxicating and ate as much as they could get. Many of Mukunda's friends were macrobiotic followers, and at first they fastidiously avoided all the sweets. But gradually the enthusiasm of the others wore down their resistance, and they became captivated by the Swami's expert cooking. "God is a good cook," said Janaki. Bruce, who had missed the first initiation, was seeing the Vedic fire sacrifice and tasting the Swami's kachoris for the first time. He resolved on the spot to dedicate himself to Krishna consciousness and become one of Swamiji's disciples as soon as possible. Almost all the visitors personally approached Swamiji to thank him and congratulate him. He was happy and said it was all Krishna's blessings, Krishna's grace. After the ceremony, Mukunda and his wife entertained many of the devotees and guests in their apartment. The evening had put everyone in high spirits, and Hayagriva was reciting poetry. Then someone turned on the television to catch the scheduled interview with Allen Ginsberg, the poet. And much to everyone's happiness, Allen began playing harmonium and chanting Hare Krishna. He even said that there was a Swami on the Lower East Side who was teaching this mantra yoga. Krishna consciousness was new and unheard of, yet now the devotees were seeing a famous celebrity perform kirtan on television. The whole evening seemed auspicious. Back at his apartment, Prabhupada, along with a few helpers, cleaned up after the ceremony. He was satisfied. He was introducing some of the major elements of his Krishna consciousness mission. He had initiated disciples, he had married them, and he had feasted the public with Krishna prasadam. "If I had the means," he told his followers, "I could hold a major festival like this every day." This Prabhupada's mood idea was that people are attracted by festivals like Rath Yatra or any big ceremony. People see the Rath Yatra coming down the street, and naturally they get a little excited and they want to take part in it. And they join in it gladly. Although if there's one or two devotees out chanting on Harinam, that's a great thing. And that is a wonderful thing for one. Sometimes the Tri Shakti, she goes out by herself and chants like for 4 hours straight by herself. That's pretty amazing. That's not easy to do. And it's a wonderful thing. And people are attracted, but when there's a big festival, then many, many people come just to see, well, what's going on? And there's music, there's dancing. Yeah, I like that. And then they end up at the park and there's a big feast. And they definitely like that. And so Prabhupada's spirit is one of the preaching, most important preaching methods was big festivals for Krishna. And the big festivals for Krishna. And he said, "I could hold a major festival like this every day." And that's like Vrindavan. Is when Krishna in Vrindavan, every day is a huge festival. Every day it's full of joy and bliss, and an infinite number of devotees are singing and dancing and kirtan and worshiping Krishna in the temples, and every day is a festival in Krishna consciousness. In material world, you need like a really big reason to have a festival. It was somebody's birthday, or the 4th of July, or Christmas, and there's a big, there has to be some reason. And most festivals are the main feature of them is getting drunk and acting like an idiot. But in Krishna consciousness, every day is a festival. Krishna is always, everything is festive. Okay, so Srimad Bhagavatam, the appearance day of Lord Varahadev, and what chapter?
13.
Yes, the appearance of Lord Varahadev. Okay, so I'll read some of this and get in class. Okay, text one. Sri Shuka Vacha Nishamya Vacham Varato Mune Punyatamam Ripa Bhuya Paprachcha Koravyo Vasudeva Kutatutaha. Sri Sukadeva Goswami said, O King, after hearing all these most virtuous topics from the sage Maitreya, Vidura inquired further on the topics of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which he adored to hear. Purport. The word Adritaha is significant because it indicates that Vidura had a natural inclination for hearing the transcendental message of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he was never fully satisfied, though continuing to hear these topics. He wanted to hear more and more, so that he could be more and more blessed by the transcendental message. Vidura uvacha savai svayambhuva samra priya putra svayambhuva pratilabhya priyam patnim kim chakara tato mune. Vidura said, O great sage, what did Svayambhuva, the dear son of Brahma, do after obtaining his very loving wife? Charitam tasya raja arshe adirajasya saktama bruhime shadana shadatanaya vishvakshenashrayo yaso. O best of the virtuous, the original king of kings, Manu, was a great devotee of the personality of Godhead, Hari, and thus it is worth hearing of his sublime character and activities. Please describe them. I am very eager to hear. Purport. Srimad Bhagavatam is full of the transcendental topics of the personality of Godhead and his pure devotees. In the absolute world, there is no difference in quality between the Supreme Lord and his pure devotees. Therefore, hearing the topics of the Lord and hearing of the character and activities of the pure devotee have the same result, namely the development of devotional service. Shutasya pumsam suchira shiramasya manvanjasa shirabhir idita rita tatta kunana shavanam mukunda padaravindam hiteshu yesham. Persons who hear from a spiritual master with great labor and for a long time must hear from the mouths of pure devotees about the character and activities of pure devotees. Pure devotees always think within their hearts at the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead who awards his devotees liberation. Purport. Transcendental students are those who undergo great penance in being trained by hearing the Vedas from a bona fide spiritual master. Not only must they hear about the activities of the Lord, but they must also hear about the transcendental qualities of the devotees who are constantly thinking of the lotus feet of the Lord within their hearts. A pure devotee of the Lord cannot be separated from the lotus feet of the Lord for even a moment. Undoubtedly, the Lord is always within the hearts of all living creatures, But they hardly know about it because they are deluded by the illusory material energy. The devotees, however, realize the presence of the Lord, and therefore they can always see the lotus feet of the Lord within their hearts. Such pure devotees of the Lord are as glorious as the Lord. They are, in fact, recommended by the Lord as more worshipable than He Himself. Worship of the devotee is more potent than worship of the Lord. It is therefore the duty of the transcendental students to hear of pure devotees, as explained by similar devotees of the Lord, because one cannot explain about the Lord or His devotee unless one happens to be a pure devotee himself. In regards to that last statement, can't explain about the Lord unless he's a pure devotee himself. There's one interesting thing I heard Prabhupada say in a lecture one time. He said very clearly, he said, all my disciples, they're pure devotees. And he said, maybe not so advanced, but pure devotees. He would often say that sometimes. And the reason he said that is because disciples, you would normally think, well, if he's not advanced, how could he be a pure devotee? But we always think they're necessary for each other. And, you know, but in this particular reference, Prabhupada was making sort of a distinction. That because his disciples are so dedicated and so sincere, it's like that story of Mother Malati, Prabhupada, when she was in Mayapur. I can't remember all the details, but she was cooking for Prabhupada, and there was some guest there, other Indians, and Prabhupada said that this disciple, she would die for me if I asked her to, and I would die for her. So she's an American. She's only a devotee a few years. You might say, oh, how could she be so advanced? But Prabhupada considered her and his disciples pure devotees because they're just so dedicated, so working so hard. We were talking to Amarnath last night. We were saying that, this verse says, persons who hear from a spiritual master with great labor and for a long time. And in the purport, Prabhupada says that transcendental students are those who undergo great penance in being trained by hearing the Vedas from a bona fide spiritual master. So it's saying that in the beginning, everyone was a new devotee and nobody had ever heard of Krishna consciousness before. But nowadays, it's like, oh, Krishna consciousness, yeah, I've heard of that. That's been around for a long time. I know, I've heard of that. I go to the temple sometimes, I do some chanting, we get together and we do some bhajans once in a while. And, there's a tendency now for people to just take it for sort of for granted. But the real thing is just like another part of their life. Like I do this, I play baseball, and then I go to the temple. I go to the temple sometimes. And so it's meant to be a full dedication, hearing for a long time with great labor, undergoing severe penance and being trained by hearing the Vedas from a bona fide spiritual master. It's different for many people now, but that doesn't really matter. I mean, it matters, but in the ultimate sense, it's not that big a deal, because anyone who comes in contact with Krishna consciousness, even just a little bit, right in the beginning, we're not showing so many signs of devotion or so much commitment, but the potency of the Hare Krishna mantra, the prasadam, the association of devotees, the seeing the deities, the potency of that is so powerful that it has to have effect. Somebody put on Facebook a couple of days ago something from Prabhupada where It's not, he was saying that he was talking about the songs by the Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Narottam Das Thakur and so, the previous acharyas. And he said that these are like, I don't remember the exact words, but he said it's like they're like thunderbolts that crack, like a thunderbolt if it hits a big, huge tree. It could crack the tree, knock it down, burn it. It might be a big, might have been there for hundreds or thousands of years, but a big, strong tree. But a lightning, the cloud, a thunderbolt can crack it and destroy it. So he compared the songs of the previous acharyas to the thunderbolts that penetrate the heart and crack the heart, and it's like, what can you do? You have no defense. It's not like somebody can say, oh yeah, I listen to the bhajan, but it can't affect me. I'm immune. Nobody is immune. No one is immune. Everyone is a pure spirit soul, and the words of Krishna and Krishna's pure devotees will inevitably be effective. In course of time, the symptoms will become manifest. Let's read a little more. Sri Shukla Vacha Iti Bruvanam Vidaram Vinitam Sahasra Shishnas Charno Padhanam Rishta Roma Parivattayam Paniyamano Munar Abhyachashta. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna was pleased to place his lotus feet on the lap of Vidura because Vidura was very meek and gentle. The sage Maitreya was very pleased with Vidura's words, and being influenced by his spirit, he attempted to speak. Purport. The word Sahasra Shirshna is very significant. One who has diverse energies and activities and a wonderful brain is known as the Sahasra Shirshna. This qualification is applicable only to the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, and no one else. The personality of Godhead was pleased to dine sometimes with Vidura at his home, and while resting, he placed his lotus feet on the lap of Vidura. Maitreya was inspired by the thought of Vidura's wonderful fortune. The hairs of his body stood on end, and he was pleased to narrate the topics of the personality of Godhead with great delight. Maitreya uvacha itasavarya saranam jata svayambhuvo manu pranjali pranatas chedam vedagarbham abhashata. The sage Maitreya said to Vidura, after his appearance, Manu, the father of mankind, along with his wife, thus addressed the reservoir of Vedic wisdom, Brahma, with obeisances and folded hands. You are the father of all living entities and the source of their subsistence because they are all born of you. Please order us how we may be able to render service unto you. O worshipful one, please give us your direction for the execution of duty within our working capacity so that we can follow it for fame in this life and progress in the next. Lord Brahma said, O my dear son, O Lord of the world, I am very pleased with you and I desire all blessings for both you and your wife. You have without reservation surrendered yourself unto me with your heart for my instructions. O hero, your example is quite befitting a son in relationship with his father. This sort of adoration for the superior is required. One who is beyond the limit of envy and who is sane accepts the order of his father with great delight and executes it to his full capacity. When the four previous sons of Brahma, the sages Sanaka, Sanatana, Sanandana, and Sanat Kumar, refused to obey their father, Brahma was mortified, and his anger was manifested in the shape of Rudra. That incident was not forgotten by Brahma, and therefore the obedience of Manu Swayambhuva was very encouraging. From the material point of view, the four sages' disobedience to the order of their father was certainly abominable, but because such disobedience was for a higher purpose, they were free from the reaction of disobedience. Those who disobey their fathers on material grounds, however, are surely subjected to disciplinary reaction for their disobedience. Manu's obedience to his father on material grounds was certainly free from envy, and in the material world it is imperative for ordinary men to follow the example of Manu. So these last two verses are like really the essence, basis of Krishna consciousness. I'm very pleased with you, and I desire all blessings for both you and your wife. You have without reservation surrendered yourself unto me with your heart for my instructions. And that's the attitude of a father for the children, the son, and also for the spiritual master and his disciples. And Prabhupada emphasizes the relationship of inferiors and superiors here, a very important part of human society. In society nowadays, there's very little respect for elders, or very little respect for anyone, practically. And we're practically trained to be disrespectful, or at least unrespectful. But Krishna consciousness, we learn to respect elders, we learn to respect elder devotees, elder people, fathers, mothers. When Brahmananda and Garga Muni got initiated, maybe probably the second initiation, and their mother came. And mother wasn't a devotee, and she didn't really like them being devotees, but she came to the initiation because they were sons, and so she was, must have been nice, but she wasn't. And then the Prabhupada asked her for a donation of money, and she said, "I've already given you two sons." I don't know exactly how she said it. Maybe she didn't say it like that. She said, "Well, I've already given you two sons. What do you want from me?" But Prabhupada, after the initiation was over, he told Brahmananda and Garga Muni to go offer obeisances to their mother. So Prabhupada understood. If somebody was disrespectful of father and mother, like Satrup Maharaj, when he became a devotee and his parents and sister realized that he was serious about it, then after just a couple of months, they just rejected him. And they rejected him. They said, we don't want to, if you give this up, then you can come be part of our family again, but if you keep up with this Krishna consciousness, then we don't want to have anything to do with you. And he came from a good family. It's not like his father and mother or his sister were like mean, wretched people or anything. They had a good family relationship. Prabhupada, Satrup Maharaji, respected his father and mother. And he was shocked. But they were serious. They meant it. So in a situation like that, then what can you, or in a situation where the father and mother want to maintain the relationship but are very negative towards Krishna consciousness and critical, or try to deprogram someone. There was one devotee, the devotee who made the stained glass, the gopi doors there, his parents were having the new programmers try to catch him and kidnap him. He couldn't go outside the temple because they were always outside watching for him. And his parents hired him for like many thousands of dollars to kidnap him. and he knew it. And so he had to get to another temple to get away from him. And I mean, he was overage. This wasn't a case of where he was underage. He was, you know, 20, early 20s. He could do what he wanted legally, but his parents were being ridiculous, so he was going to go to another temple to hide. And so one night during the Sunday feast, when people were leaving, he walked out. He wore a sari, and he was kind of slight, thin build, and he wore a sari, and he had his head covered. All the women had their head covered. And he walked out with a bunch of Matajis out of the temple, and that's how he made his escape.
So much drama.
I know.
So in a situation like that, you have to disobey your parents. The ultimate goal is to please Krishna and to be a devotee. And if anybody, even your own parents, are against it, then what can you do? You have no choice. You have a choice, but for Krishna consciousness, you really have no choice. There is another example when Raghunath Das Goswami was running away from home all the time, and then one time he made it to Mayapur? He made it to Jagannath Puri. And Lord Chaitanya or Lord Nityananda sent him back.
Oh, that's Mayapur. Shantipur.
And Lord Chaitanya sent him back. He sent him back home. He said, stay with your family for a while. His father and mother were locking him up in a room. And then he was always trying to escape. And he did escape. And he got there, but Lord Chaitanya said, go back, be a good boy. And of course, in that case, his father and mother were, you know, I'm sure they were Krishna conscious in their way. But he wanted to run away and join Lord Chaitanya and move in the temple. He wants to run. So Lord Chaitanya said, go back, be a good boy for a while, and then later you can join me. So later he got away again, and his father was saying we should lock him up, and his wife said that, he has a wife that's as beautiful as the goddess of fortune. He has all the money that he could possibly desire, and if that can't chain him down, then how do you expect to keep him locked up here? We can't hold. So they relented, and they let him go. He was already gone. They relented, and then he left. And then his father was giving him a lot of money. He was sending him a lot of money when he joined the devotees. You know, he was like Ambarish, probably. Yeah, he was rich, and his father was rich, and he was giving him tons of money. So even in that case, his father and mother were devotees. It doesn't really say exactly what their commitments, but we can assume that there was some kind of devotees of Krishna. But they didn't want their son to go away and just, you know, they probably wanted him to be in the family business and take over for the father when he died, but he just wanted to.
Especially Jewish.
Yeah.
Jewish.
Oh yeah, it's not uncommon, but it's really strong in Indian culture also. It's over at Raju's house. Him and his wife are really nice. They're devotees. They got some Mayavadi in them.
Who's the
Raju? He comes once in a while and he plays the drum. You know, I don't know if you know him, but he has a mustache. He looks kind of like Prabhupada when Prabhupada was like 30 years old or something. He's got the same kind of mustache.
No, I'm trying to imagine Prabhupada with a mustache. And I'm trying to match somebody in the congregation with
that. Yeah, he reminds me. Anyway, I was over at their house and he would say, my house, it doesn't belong to me. It's still in my father and mother's name. It's their house. And they're in India. He's in America. He's a doctor, a research doctor, and his wife works, and they bought the house. But they're saying, this isn't my house. This house belongs to my father and mother. If they want me to decorate it, they said his mother came and chose all the paint colors and chose the curtains and everything, and his wife, they just accept whatever. And they said, it's not even in his name. It's in his father and mother's name, I think. Anyway, they consider it their house. So that's, I mean, that is, example. Generally, yeah, so the point is generally the children, like the disciples, should be very respectful to their parents if the situation allows it. But if the situation doesn't allow it, you have to choose Krishna. So we didn't get much into the word Varahadev, but I'm giving class tonight, and we'll probably talk about the word Varahadev. Okay. I'll go to Prabhupada.